Ours will be forever the myth.
You're the king of kings, though.
There's always a pecking order. The little peckers never mess with the big peckers. So I'm a rooster, and he's a chicken.
This episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast is brought to you by our sponsor, Florida Alternative Medicine. All right, welcome everybody to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, where we talk to the legends of bodybuilding, and we also talk about the history of bodybuilding. I'm your host, John Hansen, and on today's show, we have a special podcast today. We're going to do a tribute to Chris Dickerson, who passed away last year on December 23rd, and I was able to get the great Boyer Coe and Roy Callender to join us for the interview, and along with Boyer and Roy, we're going to have Bill Nealon. Bill is a judge out here in the Florida area. And Bill was also a very close friend of Chris Dickerson for the last 20 years. So the three of us, Boyer, Roy, and Bill, are going to give our memories of Chris Dickerson and try to give a little tribute to the great Chris Dickerson, 1982 Mr. Olympia, who passed away at the age of 82 years old. All right. This podcast is a little bit late in the week. I apologize for that, but I was a little bit under the weather this week. I don't know what, got some kind of bug or something. I was feeling very achy, body aches for like one day, and then just kind of out of it for a couple of days. So it took me a while to get the podcast up. So I apologize for that, guys. But I think you're really going to enjoy the show. And when we get done with the interview with Boyer and Roy Callender and Bill Nealon, I am going to read another article, and this one is about Chris Dickerson. I think it was the very first article that was done about Chris in the Muscle and Fitness magazines. Of course, Chris was involved with the AAU and the WBBG and NABBA in the 60s and 70s. But this issue comes from, it's the January 1980 issue of Muscle and Fitness, and it's called Elegance is the Game, Dickerson's the Name. It was written by Bill Reynolds and Armad Tanney, so it's a profile piece. Like I said, I think the first one they did about Chris in Muscle and Fitness magazine, this is when Chris was finally coming into the IFBB, and he competed in the 1979 Mr. Olympia, where he got sixth place, and then he went to the Canada Cup, I think a couple of weeks after that, and he won it, and he was in much better shape, and he beat out Mike Mentzer and Boyer Coe and a lot of the guys who beat him at the Olympia, so really made a great debut that year in his first year as a pro with the IFBB. All right. So what else is going on with you guys? I know we're getting some crazy weather out there in the United States. I don't know how it is around the rest of the world, too. Winter is here. And I know my parents' house, they had like -9 today out in Chicago. So we're getting a little bit colder weather out here in Florida, too. But I really can't complain compared to what some other people are getting. I got some good news. I'm going to be doing a seminar at a gym out in Massachusetts, and that's going to be March 19th and 20th. So I'm looking forward to that. It's going to be a two-day seminar. As I get more information on it, I'll get you the name of the gym and where you guys can sign up if you're interested in, if you're in the area. It should be a really, really great seminar. It's going to be a two-day thing. I was going to do something like this out here in Tampa a couple of years ago, but then COVID started that year, so we had to cancel it, and I never got around to doing it again. So it's going to be a combination of a lecture, and we're going to go into the gym, and I'm going to demonstrate exercises on how to work out and do the right form for all the different exercises. So should be really, really good. I'm looking forward to that. That should be right after the Arnold Classic in March. So as I said, I'll let you guys know more about that, and I'll put the information up on my John Hansen Fitness page as well under seminars. All right. We did get some emails. I think we got some from last week too, but I didn't get a chance to read them. So I want to read those. This one says, "Hey, John, how are you, sir? My name is Kenny Arroyo. I'm from Los Angeles. I saw your interview with our late mutual friend, Rick Drayson. I used to train with him at the North Hollywood Gold's Gym and at times with Franco Colombo up to the point when he passed away. They both gave me great information as far as developing the long head bicep peak. Though I have seen improvement, I still don't feel satisfied. I'm reaching out to you because I've only seen two people with a very developed bicep peak, you and Arnold. Is it possible you could recommend one exercise for the bicep peak? Thank you in advance. Best regards, Ken." Well, I think, Ken, the bicep peak is really a lot of genetics. Albert Beckles had a great bicep peak, and I think his was pretty much genetics. I know mine, I had a bicep peak when I was in eighth grade, even before I started really lifting weights.
But I think one great exercise that not too many people do anymore is the concentration curl. And if you watch the movie Pumping Iron, the way Arnold used to do them, where he's bending over and he doesn't have his arm supported at all, and he's curling it up. And when you do that without any support, where you're not putting the leg against the, or the arm against the leg, you really have to concentrate, and you can't use really a lot of weight. But if you focus and go all the way up, and you can really, really build that peak. So that's one really good exercise. Another one would be doing one-arm dumbbell preacher curls. I used to do those when I was like 15 years old and I was working out at home, and I would put bench on a really steep incline. And for some reason, that also really gets the bicep peak. It also, of course, gets the lower bicep, which is what preacher curls do. But I really got a great peak contraction from doing that exercise. So give those two a try. This one says, "Hey, John, I'm so glad the podcast keeps going from strength to strength, which is down to your hard work and great selection of guests. I really enjoyed the 81 part one review, and it made me realize, I think, how I reflect on one of the most talked about years in bodybuilding. Forgetting the controversy of Franco winning, to think that the show, which had an absolute peak Padilla, a peak Platts, who both arguably should have taken the Olympia crown, should and could have also had a recovered Zane on stage, a what sounds like a peak Boyer Coe, Menser if he hadn't walked away, Robbie Robinson, who went off from the IFBB, the list goes on and on. If the IFBB had not caused all the problems in 1980, which escalated in 81, we would have had a truly amazing lineup. Your revisiting the Grand Prix results, NABBA and WABA shows in 81 reminded me that the Olympia really was a shallow pool of what was a great ocean of great bodybuilders that year. It also made me think how anticlimactic the 82 Olympia then was. I started bodybuilding in the late 80s, and 82 was one of the first VH tapes I got handed to at the gym, and I was blown away when I first watched it. But on reflection, if I had been a fan in the 80s, it would have been a bit of a letdown with Danny coming in out of peak shape, Platts injured but still competing, Dickerson past his peak, but after 2 years of raw deals, deserving the win on merit maybe, as Casey and Zane both looked better than Chris that year. I could go on, but I thank you for the shows, which brings up such great memories and stirs up new thoughts on the great past. Paul Thor from North Wales, UK." All right, Paul, thank you for that email. Yeah, you make a great point. 81 really could have been an amazing contest. I think Jerry and I mentioned that when we were talking about the 81 Olympia. We did have a totally peaked Tom Platts, Danny Padilla, Roy Callender. And then can you imagine if Boyer Coe would have been in it, looking like he looked in 81, because he was in really great shape that year, probably the best he's ever looked. And then Mike Menser, if he would have improved upon his 1980 condition. And if we would have had a best ever Frank Zane coming back to Columbus after that injury he had in 1980. I mean, wow, what a year that would have been. That would have really been amazing. Like you said, Robbie too. And even like Sergio, if we ever could have got Sergio back, because Sergio was back competing in 1980 and 1981. So that really would have been amazing. And one more email here. He says, "Hey, John, my name is Matt. I've always been interested in bodybuilding from afar, but I felt it was too late to get involved. A few years ago, I realized that wasn't the right way to think, and I began making changes in my eating and exercise habits. I also went heavily down the bodybuilding history rabbit hole. Haha. I'm a big fan of the silver era, and I gravitate towards guys like Grimmick, Reeves, Ross, Steven, Park, Tanny, Hayslop, Howarth, Garanda, etc. The mindset, philosophies, and physiques of these guys really motivate me. I have fallen victim to what I think a lot of folks new to the iron game have, and that's endlessly searching for the quote-unquote perfect routine. So I trained directionless for a couple of years, and I still have my struggles. It's amazing how much stuff is out there. Pretty dizzying, but I believe keeping it simple and sticking to the basics is the key. I wanted to reach out because I have been enjoying your interviews. A couple of the ones with John Little regarding Mike Menser are really interesting. While it's a sad story, I find some of Mike's thoughts and theories regarding training and the human body unique. I also think it's cool that you're natural. It gives guys like me who are also natural motivation. I'd love to chat bodybuilding, history, and writing should you ever have the time. Thanks and keep up the good work, Matt." All right. Thank you, Matt. Yeah, I agree with you, Matt. I think just keep it simple. Keep with the basics. That's the best way to train. The way I'm training right now, I train 4 days a week. I train each body part once a week. I do chest and triceps on Monday, legs on Tuesday, take off Wednesday, and then Thursday I do shoulders and calves. Friday back and biceps. And that seems to work good for me, especially being in my 50s. It gives me enough recuperation. It allows me to increase the weights each week. And it seems like you read the MP6 book, so you're familiar with the program I use, where the weights go up progressively each week over a six-week cycle. So I think that's the way to do it. And just keep the volume moderate. Don't have to do a lot of volume. The more intensity you train, and if you're increasing the weights, and if you're using the basic compound movements, you can't do a lot of sets. You don't want to do a lot of sets because you'll end up overtrained. So I think that's the way to do it. And if you guys want to send me an email, I love reading your emails. Just send them to naturalolympia@gmail.com and I will read it on the air. All right. I am getting over this cold or flu bug or whatever the hell I got, so I'm not going to talk too long. So here is our podcast about our tribute to Chris Dickerson, where we've got the great Boyer Coe, Roy Callender, and Bill Nealon all giving their memories of Chris Dickerson. Here we go. All right, welcome back to the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. I have a very special show this week. We are doing a tribute to Chris Dickerson, who passed away on December 23rd, 2021. And so joining us, I have our good friend Boyer Coe, four-time Mr. Universe, one of the best professional bodybuilders in the 1970s and 80s. And Boyer and Chris had a long relationship on the competitive stage. They were competing for almost 30 years together. So welcome to the show, Boyer. Glad to have you back. Thank again. You,
nice for you to invite me on. Thank you.
And we also have Bill Nealon. Bill was one of Chris's closest friends out here in Florida. He's a judge and a gym owner and a personal trainer out here in the Florida area. So, Bill, welcome to the show.
Thank you, John. Great to be here.
All right. Thanks for joining me, guys. Well, Boyer, why don't we start with you? Like I said, you and Chris go way back. Do you remember the year that you met when you first started competing with him?
Well, it was much further back than you remember. I first met Chris the night I won the Teenage Mr. America.
Oh, wow.
That was back in 1966. Okay. I didn't even think at that time Chris had even started competing yet. I met him because he was good friends with Dennis Tenorino and Joe Abender, and I knew both of those. Dennis had won the year before I did at the Teenage Mr. America, so he was there. And then Joe Abender, you know, was a longtime friend. I knew him well, and that's how I got introduced to Chris. So that goes back to 1966.
Wow. Where was that contest, Boyer?
It was in West Paterson, New Jersey.
Okay.
I never will forget because I arrived in West Paterson and they had a big riot going on at the time. It was, you know, it was a big deal about, voting rights and then the blacks and the whites, something. I arrived in the middle of that, but somehow or another, I managed to get to the hotel. I mean, I'm this country kid from Louisiana. I had first time ever been to New Jersey. Arrived in the middle of it, and then it's like about 105 degrees too. So,
right.
But anyway, that's the first time I was introduced to Chris.
Okay. And then your first contest together, do you remember that? I remember you guys were in the 1969 Mr. America that you won. He was in that, right? Was there one before that?
I mean, we were competing before that. And the first contest I remember we competed against one another was in 67. It was at the Junior Mr. America.
Okay.
I think that was in, I think it was maybe in York, Pennsylvania. But
okay.
I do remember Dennis Tenorino, myself, and Chris all stayed in the same room.
Oh, wow.
In those days, nobody paid for anything. So
right.
I was in college. I had enough money to get a plane ticket up there, and then we split the hotel room. So we all stayed in the same room. And I think Dennis won the Junior Mr. America contest that night.
Yeah. What did you think of Chris's physique when you first saw him?
Well, Chris, the first thing that stands out, he had these fantastic calves.
Yeah.
You know, and he was always in shape. I mean, he was not an exciting bodybuilder, but he was always very, very well conditioned and a polished poser and always a gentleman.
Yeah. Bill, I think you told the story on our show before, like when you met Chris, but if you could tell that story again, I think that was at a contest, right?
Yes. And just to put things in perspective, John, and you may go back this far, but, you know, when I was coming up and I was a kid in the late 60s, people like Boyer and Chris, you never dreamed of meeting these guys. They were images in the magazine. Mm-hmm. And you know, I never heard Boyer's voice or Chris's voice back then. They were just in the magazines. We'd buy the next issue to see what they were doing and try to follow their routines. And I had pictures of Boyer and Chris, and I think a picture of Frank Zane on my bedroom wall. And, you know, my parents would come in and shake their heads like, you know, what's wrong with our son? You know, we're not football players or race car drivers but that's what I wanted to be like. That's what I wanted to look like.
Yeah.
And, but again, never dreamed of meeting these guys. There was no internet or nothing like that back then. In fact, we had to wait sometimes months to find out how these guys did in the competitions because the results wouldn't be published until you got the issues of the magazines.
Which was months later, right?
Yeah. So I was at the 2003 NPC Nationals in Miami with my buddy, and we thought the prejudging tickets were also good for the evening show, but they were not. So I told Mike, wait here, I'll go, you know, work my way through the crowd to the box office to get, you know, the tickets for the finals. And it was so packed, the lobby was so packed, I had to walk sideways. So I'm walking sideways, and who comes right across me chest to chest but Chris Dickerson.
Yeah. You
know, heroes. There he is. And I looked right at him face to face, and I said, you're Chris Dickerson. And he agreed. And then I proceeded to tell him more about himself than he knew.
Right,
and
right.
I know something about you that very few people know. When you were in high school, your vocal coach told you you should try lifting weights to expand your rib cage and lung capacity for your singing. And Chris frowned and backed his head up and he said, how do you know that? I said, because I read about it in an Ebony magazine. I bought the magazine, Chris, in 1970 because you were in it. And he said, that was 33 years ago. I said, yes, Chris, that's the type of impact you had on me.
Wow.
So flash forward 4 years, I'm judging the Southern States. But anyway, at the time that night, I said to Chris, you know, he was going to get his seat. I gave him my card and I said, Chris, if you're ever in Florida, please, I'd love to show you my facility and take you out to lunch and talk with you. And he said, sure. And again, flash forward 4 years later, I'm judging the Southern States. And right before intermission, I just turned around from the judges' table to take a look at the crowd. And sitting right behind me in the VIPs is none other than Chris Dickerson. So I turned around and said, oh, Chris, you probably don't remember me. And he pointed at me and he said, Ebony Magazine, right? And I said, yes. So I said, I'd love to take you to lunch, Chris. So we went to lunch the following Saturday, and that started off our friendship for 14 years.
14 years, wow. Hey, Roy, can you hear us?
You got me now?
I got you now. There you are. Okay.
Aha.
Welcome to the show, Roy.
You tell everybody my wife is helping me. I just rushed in, man. Just left the client, rushed out of the shower.
And, all right. Appreciate it.
No, for you, man. It's no problem. So happy I could get here.
Roy, could you switch your phone on the side? Can you turn it on the side? There we go. Yeah, perfect.
I thought you were telling me I'm so big. But,
well, you are.
I wish.
Well, we got Boyer Cohen and Bill Neal.
Good to hear from you.
Hi, Roy. It's an honor. Big fan.
Oh, same here, man. Same here. No, you
yeah,
are.
But you don't know me. I know you, though.
Well, I know you now, so.
All right. Well, Roy, we were just saying how we met Chris. Well, the first time we met Chris. Can you tell us the story when you first met Chris Dickerson?
I was at World Gym. I was at World Gym in California, Santa Monica.
Okay.
The original. And we were preparing for some of the Grand Prix. And he came over to me and said, Roy, listen, man, I was watching you over there. I think you get it. You're getting pretty serious, huh? I said, I have to. This is my bread. I got to go to Pittsburgh. I got to make sure you don't beat me. And we hugged. We trained for a little while. And next time I saw him was in Pittsburgh Grand Prix, I think it was. And he looked at me after the competition. He won. I came second or third. He looked at me and said, I think we're going to have some battles going forward, Roy, okay? expect them. I said, sure, man, from you, coming from you, if I can match you, I'd be pretty good.
Yeah.
He was always a very, this is why I broke my neck to get here, because I wanted to say something, as long as it's Chris. Mm-hmm. I wanted to be able to come on and just, if it's in this little way, pay my respects. Because this guy was, listen, if you can name me one bodybuilder besides Lee Haney that wasn't a big head.
Mm-hmm.
Chris Dickerson. Mm. Simple, humble, quiet. I can't say enough about this guy. Mm. Helpful. I was talking about calves, and he said to me, "Roy, don't worry about my calves. They're partially genetic, partially the way I walk." Mm-hmm. And he gave me a few hints about my calves, which I used going into the 1981 Olympia, which is also something that Aaron has said and Rick Wayne had said. And my calves, if you remember correctly, were the best they were best ever in 1981.
Yeah.
Even Julian Blomart or Jacques Blomart came down and said, "Roy, I always used to knock you for your calves, man, but I can't knock you today." I have to give it to you.
Yeah. What I really like about those old stories about you guys is, like you were saying, you guys stayed in a hotel room together and everything, and there was really that sense of camaraderie, I guess, in the 1960s where you could hang out together and compete with each other and stuff.
Oh yeah, oh yeah, oh yes.
As Roy mentioned, people were a lot more helpful to one another.
Oh yeah.
There was no jealousy. You just worked out. You just wanted to do as good as you could. And the next guy beat you, that was fine. You know,
it
was
big deal.
The thing is this, and maybe Roy feels the same way. To be honest, all the years I competed, I never had a great deal of respect for the judges. Because you stand up on the stage, you know, put your heart and soul in preparation, and the judges are kind of just lackadaisical, looking around, joke. They weren't really paying attention. They had no desire or no understanding of all of the effort that you put into that. So yeah. I just kind of accepted whatever I got and went about my business. I just.
But I think they like being called judge.
Yeah. The only thing I wanted to do is, if I knew I looked better than the last contest I was in, I was happy. As long as I was improving, that's what I cared about.
Yeah. Was that when they were still doing the weightlifting and the powerlifting before the bodybuilding? Did they use some of the judges from that?
Now, this is a little bit different from when Roy was competing. In the AAU, they used the same judges in Olympic lifting competition as they did in bodybuilding. As a matter of fact, they wouldn't even start the bodybuilding competition till the weightlifting was completely over with.
Right.
They didn't really care. You know, you would just, I don't even know if they knew anything about bodybuilding.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, I didn't know that.
John, it was so different then. It was so different, and Boy will tell you too, we had to travel to the shows because there were far and few between. It was usually at a YMCA, and we'd wait around all day till the powerlifting was over. They'd come out and they'd sweep the chalk off the gym floor. They'd set up this makeshift stage. Not kidding. They'd hang a light off the basketball hoop. And then 23 guys would come out about 11 at night.
Yeah.
Oh, weight classes, no music, no nothing. And I'm looking out at the judges, some of the powerlifters' wives, say director. And I'm saying, these are the bodybuilding judges? And at 150 pounds, I never got looked at.
Yeah. You know,
the guy with the big arms, big chest, kind of weak legs, big and smooth, would win.
Yeah.
Every time. rear double biceps, front lat spread, rear lat spread.
Abs. This is funny.
Okay. Call out the first top five. See you next year.
Yeah.
This is funny.
What just happened?
I can remember that the first teenage Miss America contest that was the prejudging for bodybuilding didn't get started until 3 o'clock in the morning.
Come on.
I sat around all day long. It was in Pittsburgh, okay? No, excuse me, in Philadelphia.
Okay.
And So we go through, I mean, you're falling asleep, you know, it's like 3 or 4
right.
o'clock in the morning. And then you got to be back down there at 9 o'clock the next morning for the interview. That's when they had to prove your athletic ability.
Yeah.
That was in the AAU. Finally, they did away with all of that.
No.
So you guys also competed, all of you, Boyer and Roy and Chris, were all together. You had to be competing on a lot of the shows in NABBA, right, in London, because you were all competing in the early 70s, right?
Well, the very first – that's when I first met Roy. In the 1969 NABBA Juniors, that's when I was placed right between Roy and Albert Beckles. I said,
you're right, you're right.
I couldn't pick the worst spot for me. You know, they shit. Didn't
notice. Yeah, you're right. You're right, Maurier. You're right, man.
You guys were all in the same class. Boyer,
yeah.
Ryan.
We're all in the medium class, yeah.
Medium height, yeah.
Wow, what a lineup.
That's when we would turn around and Albert and I will argue who's going to be second. That's true. That's a true story.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
So, Roy, when you competed with Chris, what impressed you about him? I was just reading some old articles from like 1980, 1981 about a lot of those Grand Prix. And they said, you know, Chris wasn't the biggest guy. And he even had a couple of weak body parts, but it was just the way that he stood on stage. And they said, in one of the articles I read, they said he was the quintessential bodybuilder. They said he was so prepared with his posing and the way he stood on stage and even his trunks and his tan and everything. His skin.
Everything.
Yeah.
Everything. That's the Bill Pearl influence, I think. But this guy, man, when we were competing in the Grand Prix, listen, Boris said it correctly. I cannot even try to go any further than that because it was fun. Nobody was a big head.
Mm-hmm.
Chris, you know, we didn't care. We cared. We cared about our check because we had to go back and pay rent or feed ourselves. But it was not a cutthroat thing like it became after that. It was fun to do. And this is what I said to you once in a previous interview. When I walked off the stage in Essen in 1987, I think it was the Olympia Revenge, I felt such a relief when I took my shorts off and put them in the garbage, put my all in the garbage, and I turned and I said to the guys, this is it for me, man. I'm going back to Canada. Lee Haney just convinced me that, no, I should leave this thing alone. 1987, October 31st or November 1st.
Mm-hmm. That was your last show.
That last one. Walked off stage, never had the desire to go back. That was it.
Yeah.
Chris also thought when he saw me later, why do you quit? I had to quit, man. I don't think with Lee Haney coming along now, I have a chance. I'm about 6, 7, 8 years older than he is. No, mm-hmm. no chance.
Yeah.
And, I just turned to teaching and personal training after that.
Okay.
Politics.
Hey, Bill, when you were talking with Chris when you first met him, did he talk a lot about those earlier days in bodybuilding when he got into it?
No. I kind of urge him on to get him to talk about it. Mm-hmm. You know, and he had some old notebooks that we were going through because at one point we were trying to put together a biography for Chris.
Yeah.
And he had some of these old notebooks. And Boyer, I don't know if you did so many, Boyer, but I remember one year, Chris competed about 12 times. I think 1966 or 67. You know, Mr. Colonial, Mr. DC, and just like every few weeks, he was competing mm-hmm. for about 8 months.
Mm-hmm.
So there were a lot of shows he was doing. Yeah. And that old AAU. And then the old AAU almost had kind of a tier system. You had to build yourself up and get seen in front of those old AAU judges. And they had their favorites. They were, mm-hmm. I'll tell you that.
Yeah.
It's news to me. I never heard those stories before.
Yeah.
Oh, the AAU, yeah.
Yeah, you see, particularly in the South, that's all you had. There was no IFBB. That was basically just the East Coast.
Okay.
I recall they had a lot of contests. I can remember one summer, essentially they had a contest every weekend. I competed throughout the summer. I competed, this is going back into in the 60s. This was before I got into the national competition. I could do 12 shows. I went in a contest every weekend for 3 months.
How do you guys do that?
It was all fun to me, you know? Every weekend, we'd go 300-400 miles and compete in a contest.
Yeah.
My God.
Yeah.
My history pales in comparison. My experience didn't even come close.
Yeah, boy, I don't know if you remember, I interviewed Ellington Darden, and he was telling me he met you when you were 17 years old.
Yeah.
He was telling me that story about, you know, he couldn't believe your size at 17. And he said, you blew everybody away. I think it was Mr. Texas, wasn't it? Wasn't that a Mr. Texas
guy? Yeah, it was Mr. Texas. It was in Dallas. But once again, you had to wait till that's the only reason I got into powerlifting, because I just got tired of hanging around all day doing nothing. So I'd occupy myself with doing the bench press, the squat, and deadlift till it was time to compete in the bodybuilding.
Yeah.
Wow. I made a lot of friends with different powerlifters.
Wow, man. You're so awesome. That's something else, man. Wow.
Now, Roy, you didn't have that experience, right? Because you were competing in Barbados, right? And then you were competing.
I'm here listening, man. I'm here listening. The only experience I had, I was going to save as part of it. I explained it in my book. This guy in Barbados, we copied. I was a kid growing up. Albert Beckles was the kingpin, and they copied the AAU rules. Everybody was Hoffman this and Hoffman that, and they said, and I remember quite with a lot of big smile on my face. Now I wondered how stupid we were. They were talking about competing, and the guy said, "But what is the criteria for judging for Mr. Barbados?" And the judges came out, well, complexion. Skin tone and this and that and the other. You know what they meant by complexion? They read it in the magazine to mean the lighter your skin is, the better chance you had.
Really?
Yes.
Wow.
I'm serious. They understood complexion to mean that. I was only about 15, 16 at the time. And I never had any desire to compete. And like I said, I'm black as hell. I have no chance. When I got to England, now I realized what complexion meant. Nobody ever asked him in Barbados to interpret what it meant, because if they had these skin lightening products, they thought that if you have a lighter complexion, you'll be a better bodybuilder. It's hard to explain. It's funny coming from a place like Barbados, but that is part of the history.
Wow.
Albert Beckles changed that.
Yeah. We were also talking about Chris. That's a good segue into he was the first African American to win the Mr. America contest. And as you mentioned, Roy, over in America, they had a lot of bad decisions in the AAU, where there was African American competitors who should have did better and they didn't in the AAU. And Chris was really the first one to break that barrier, and he was the first one to win the AAU Mr. America title as an African American.
But those were the times, you know. You know, those were the times. I think there are times you can look back on, like any other aspect of life. Bodybuilding was just one tiny part of it. But those were the times.
Yeah.
And Chris won because he just happened to be the best one on that day. He happened to be perfect.
Mm-hmm.
There were no weaknesses, so his time had come. He broke some ice. He broke some barriers. Opened up a way for a few of us. Those were the times, man. That's something that bodybuilding can look back on with a little bit of pride, like anything else, like baseball, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
It's, bodybuilding had to pay its fair share as well.
Yeah.
Oh, you're right about that, because there were a number of black bodybuilders, incredible bodybuilders, before Chris that should have won the Mr. America contest.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Back in history, you look at Arthur Harris.
Oh, yeah.
Incredible. And without a doubt, because I was there at, this was in 1956, as a junior Mr. America, that Sergio Oliva won, hands down. He was so good. If he would have never posed, if he'd have just walked on stage, he would have won. And I had the unfortunate experience. That was the first national contest I ever entered. I had to pose after him. So I'm slowing down and watching him pose. When my turn comes, I don't know what I'm doing on stage. I'm trying to on my routine. He won hands down. Now, a couple of weeks later was the Miss America contest. He lost. Bob Guider won.
Yeah. But
there was no way Hoffman was going to let a black man win. I don't care how good he was.
Oh, no, no.
The game of it all.
Yeah.
It's part of the history, man.
Yeah.
Why do you think it was that Chris was the first one to win?
I think the time had come.
I just think it was the time.
Yes.
You know, it was he was good, just like Roy said. He was mm-hmm. good. He was polished. He presented himself well.
Yeah,
polished.
And he was also educated. I always thought that Sergio would have done so much better had he had the ability to be educated.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know? Yeah. Chris was so well spoken.
Yeah. And you're right. That's what made the difference, you know, because you back in 1970. Now you remember Chris won, but I tell you, the guy who created all the excitement that year was Casey Viator.
Yeah.
He was only 18 years old. He won all the body parts and the most muscular. First time he ever entered. But Chris was more polished. He deserved to win.
Right.
And then as Bill said earlier, it was kind of like a pecking order. I mean, had Chris win, the next guy after Chris should have been Ken Waller. Mm-hmm. But Arthur Jones finagled things around, so he got Ken kicked out of the AAU. So that opened up the door for
Casey. Oh, man.
How did Arthur Jones get him kicked out of the AU, Boyer? Was that because of the meter?
What happened was it was some kind of little rinky-dink exercise piece of it. Okay. That Ken, somehow or another, appeared in an advertisement for it.
Mm-hmm.
And then immediately when Arthur said, oh, well, he's a professional. He got paid for it. There was no proof that he ever got paid for it.
Right.
Had a lot of influence over John Turpak and those guys in AAU. Oh, yeah, he's a professional. So that keeps him so that that's when Ken won the IFBB.
Right, right. Yeah. Yeah, I think Ken won the IFBB Mr. America that year.
He did.
Yeah. Were you in that contest too, Boyer?
What's that now?
The IFBB America?
I did one year. Yes, I did. Well, I'm trying to think. I know that it might have been one of the first I don't know if it was the Mr. America or was something that I. Oh, I know what it was.
Mr. International, wasn't it, Boyer?
Huh?
Mr. International, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's right. It was held in Tijuana.
Yeah.
International contest that Eddie Sylvester used to put on.
That was
the most incredible trophies.
Right.
I couldn't even. I had to have the thing packed up, taken it apart, shipped on a Greyhound bus. It was so heavy. It probably weighed about 200 pounds.
Wow.
It was all bronze and marble. Beautiful thing. I don't know whatever happened to it, but.
Really? Oh, yeah.
It was a fantastic trophy.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember Sergio was talking about those trophies, too, about how beautiful they were.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they went all out.
Yeah.
I got a quick story, you know, to get off the subject talking about Chris.
Uh-huh.
Very interesting. Chris and I had gone to South Africa to do a tour in the mid-70s by Warren Langman. He was a guy that brought over Dave Draper and brought over Frank Zane. And
okay.
So he says, he and I, we're still very good friends. We hit it off so well, went all over South Africa for probably 6 or 8 weeks doing shows. But what I didn't realize is because of the apartheid, the thing is you couldn't do a show. You could do a show for white people. You could do a show for the Indians, and you could do a show for the black people, but you couldn't mix it together. You had to do everything separate. Everything was segregated, okay? So Warren says, I would like to bring a black champion bodybuilder over to South Africa. So the first person I thought of was Chris Dickerson. Well, Chris agreed to come, okay? So we arrive in South Africa. Now, they wouldn't give him a visa. He went all the way to South Africa.
Wow.
Fortunately, what happened was, during the new the minister of sports, Pete Bowden, he pulled some strings. That's how we were able to get a visa for Chris. Now, we couldn't appear on stage at the same time.
What?
Neither one of us are thinking about that. So we're doing an exhibition in Johannesburg, and Chris goes on, and I'm thinking about something else. He hadn't quite got off the stage, so I come on the stage before he's completely off the stage. As soon as I finished posing, they had the police there. They wanted to arrest us.
Wow.
Because we would appear on stage at the same time.
Jeez.
So they had to do some fast talking or they'd have hauled us off to jail. Interesting story. After that, we left Johannesburg.
What up?
And we drove all the way to Cape Town, which is about 1,200-mile trip. You got to remember, driving through South Africa back in the mid-70s, there wasn't any road signs. You're just trying to follow a map. We didn't know where we were going half the time.
Right.
But we pulled in to Cape Town. We starved. We go in a restaurant to eat. We sit down. We talk. We wait. Nobody would wait on us. So finally, I said, "Hey, excuse me, lady." I said, "We'd like to get something to eat." She says, "Well, we don't serve blacks here." So I said, "Okay, fine. That's good. So we got up and left." I mean, that's how ridiculous it was back in those days.
Yeah. What year was this?
This must have been, I don't recall, but it must have been somewhere around maybe 1973. Because you remember now, at that time, they didn't even have television in South Africa.
Wow.
Yeah, it was just on the radio. Hmm. But, you know, it made sense at that time, a lot of advance.
Yeah.
I will say this. The most beautiful country I ever went to.
Really?
My God.
Cape Town was outstanding.
Mm. Wow.
What an experience.
Yeah.
I don't know if there are any of us around with that sort of experience, man. My God, this deep.
Yeah.
This deep.
Yeah. Well, Chris, the experience. That sticks with you, you know?
Yeah.
It was kind of a... I'll tell you something else that happened. Warren had came over to the United States to visit, and he loved Corvettes. But at that time, if you bought a car and you brought it to South Africa, they charged you 110% duty. So I said, okay, I'll buy the Corvette and I'll ship it to myself because I could use it, no duty, okay? And then when I got ready to leave, he paid me for it and I just left it there. So Warren was driving the Corvette in front of us. Chris and I are driving in a car on the wrong side of the road because the steering wheel is on the right side, not the left side.
Like in England.
Which it took a hell of a deal for me to get used to because I kept getting to drive the car. I'd always get in the wrong side. But anyways, I'm driving the car. Chris is riding shotgun. We're trying to figure out not to keep him running off the road. So it was amazing. We didn't know where we were going. We just stay on the highway. That's all we do.
Hey, Roy, when you were competing in that NABBA Mr. Universe, did you meet Chris in 71? Because you guys were both there in the contest. Did you get a chance to meet him? Or you guys were in separate divisions, I know.
No, 71 was the year of the ban.
Yeah, that's when Bill Pearl won. You were in that show, right?
That was the other band. I was suspended.
That's right, you were suspended, right.
Yeah, that was
I don't think Chris was in the NABBA Universe itself.
I didn't see him that year. No.
Yeah, he won the short class.
He won the short class in the amateur. He got beat by Waller.
He was in there, okay. Yeah, because I remember Waller winning the amateur version and Pearl won the professional.
Yeah, Chris lost to it.
Wow.
Yeah, I think it was Waller, Beckles, and Chris, right? Yeah, and the amateur, yeah. I thought you were second to Albert, Roy, that year. Do you remember?
Yes, that was my last. That was the year after we finished, and we went over to France to do the IFBB.
Yeah, and they wouldn't let you compete, right?
Yeah, all of us got suspended.
Yeah.
Including Sergio.
Yeah, right. Did you actually go over there, Roy? You went all the way to Paris and then they told you you couldn't compete when you got there?
I went because I didn't really take the threat from Serge Nobre very seriously. But he said, listen, Roy, if you compete here in Britain and you get to France, you will not be able to compete. Hmm. I said, but promise me I can compete. You know, he said, I'm telling you now, if you do that, that time there were this NABBA IFBB warfare going on or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
And I competed anyway because I have to keep my word. I told Oscar I would compete.
Mm-hmm.
And I competed. When I got to France, I paid the price.
Hmm. Wow.
I want to add a little something what Roy just mentioned. Oscar Heinenstein, and I'm sure yep. Roy will agree with me. He was the most honorable man I ever met. Of all the contests I competed in, I really enjoyed competing in the NABBA universe because even though they had no money, nothing, nope. The hotel was always so far, but he made you feel important. He was a very, very kind man.
Yep.
That's what I remember the most about him.
Yeah, if he told you the sky is blue, don't even look.
Yeah.
It's blue.
Right. Yeah. Now, when you guys got... Go ahead, Roy.
Oscar, I understand like that. So, when I said if he tells you the sky is blue, don't even look up, I was referring... You could say the same thing about Chris.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
If you can find anyone who can say that Chris was dishonest or disrespectful or not a real human being, not a real gentleman, find him for me. I want to see who that person is.
Mm-hmm.
Find one. I don't think you'll find one. He's a pretty cool guy.
Yeah. Yeah, what's amazing when I look back at your careers, guys, is, you know, you guys all started back in the 60s. Boy, you and Chris were competing in the AAU, and then, Roy, you were competing in NABBA back in the late 60s, early 70s. And then when you get to the late 70s, you guys are all in the IFBB together. You were all competing in the Mr. Olympia together, and then did, like, Roy, I think you were against Chris in that Canada Cup, right?
And yeah, that's the only time we managed to get the better of them.
Yeah.
I got you said you got me there, Roy. You got me there. I can't take it away from you. You got me. Patted me on the back and left.
Yeah. Well, that had to be a big deal to beat someone like Chris Dickerson because he was winning so many of the shows, right?
All the Grand Prix, yes.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I was going over those Grand Prix from 80 and 81, and he won almost every one.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about it. Okay. Yeah.
Hey, let's talk a little bit about, I know you guys don't like talking about the show, but the 80 Olympia, that very controversial one. What did you feel about Chris's placing in that? He was second in that to Arnold, so he did very well. How did you feel just from a professional body?
That's with Boyer?
Yeah, for you and Boyer, yeah.
Okay, go ahead, Roy, you talk.
Well, I'll go ahead. I'll let the master go last. This... I really don't know what to make of it. I think Paul Graham must have been awfully embarrassed because the decision had been made. The promise had been made. Listen, if you come, you'll win the competition. We get it done for you. And all he had to do was turn up. It put an awful look at it. This is 2022. And yeah. We're still talking about that. And I've never forgotten it because it was the use of my language, it was the blackest day I'd ever seen in bodybuilding. And the following year made it worse. And I had to be part of them both. That is what I look at myself. Those are two memorable years, my last 2 years competing there. Ooh, 80 and 81.
Yeah, yeah.
Disgusting. It was a shame. But our sport survived. Not what has become today, but it survived and the guy has carried on. It's a very durable sport, man.
Yeah.
Took a lot of abuse. And the guy's still been on, mainly because of people like Boyer. Boyer would never have said much. He would, I can't remember, he didn't go to the banquet. Did I go to the banquet? I went on the boat, yes, myself and Danny. Mm-hmm. Myself and one of us. I think it was Chris. He didn't hold any grudges. He didn't grunt. He didn't bitch. He didn't complain. He just maybe later, but he didn't say much about it.
Yeah. What were you gonna say, Blair?
No, I was gonna say, Roy is right. I always said after the 80 Olympics, this could have never happened if it would have been held in the States. And I was exactly wrong. Because in 81, it happened again, it was even worse. But at least I didn't make it. I got my ass kicked, and I learned not to go back. It's a shame to say Franco, because Franco's not here anymore. Franco got so mad at me because I kept telling people, I said, I can tell y'all who's going to be the 81 Mr. Olympic. Well, who is? I said, Franco's going to win.
Right.
I said, monkey see, monkey do. Franco's going to win. About 3 weeks for the contest, Franco says, calls me up. He says, why are you telling everybody I'm going to win? Because then you're going to win, Franco. You know? And he won. And then I wasn't there, but I remember the night of the show. I mean, the minute it was over, I get a phone call from Wayne D'Amelio. He said, well, you were right. Franco won.
Yeah.
And look, I got nothing against Franco, but there's no way he deserved to win that contest.
Right.
I mean,
right.
Like Frank Zane always did. He was a man with a half a body, you know, with no legs.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah. I thought, and that's in 81, I thought Roy was in incredible shape. I thought Tom Platt was in incredible shape. I thought that was probably the best Danny Padilla ever.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Scared the living daylights out of me, that guy.
Then again, you see, Chris placed second again. But Chris never had a wow physique. I mean, in other words, when he posed, it was so classical, so graceful. He was perfection, but nothing stood out. And it, like, I remember, he ended up second in the 80 Olympia, but all the talk was about Mike Mincer.
Yeah.
And really, that had nothing to do. It all started in the prejudging.
Yeah.
And I'm the one that put my foot in it. Because everybody had agreed that there would be no weight classes.
Mm-hmm.
So, except Arnold shows up last minute. He wants a weight class. Well, I understood what he was trying to do. If you got no weight classes and you got six people on stage, okay, he's got to go against five people that are certainly better than him in the condition that day.
Mm-hmm.
He's just got to go against one guy in the short or the under 200 pound class, and him, it's easy fix.
Yeah.
That's right.
So I said, okay.
That's why.
I agreed not to have a weight class. Give me your reason as to why you want a weight class. And instead of coming back with a reason, he just stands up and says, well, why don't you talk like a man? I said, I'm giving you an opportunity to talk. And that's when Mike Mincer lost it, jumped in. Had Bill Pearl not got in between him, I think Mike would have laid Arnold out on the floor.
I remember that.
Arnold was sitting down. Mike was standing over him with his fist cocked back.
Yeah.
And that was the reason why I think that bumped us down, because we had created the controversy.
Oh, okay.
If there was a bad guy in a whole bunch, it was Paul Graham, the guy that promoted. I mean, just like Roy said, he had everything was already in place for Arnold.
Yep.
And even if today, if you ask Arnold, why did you do it? He probably couldn't answer, because he really got nothing out of it. And he created a lot of ill will. You know, people never forgot about that.
Yeah, even though he won, the results were really bad in the long run, right? All the ill will and everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Got bodybuilding off television.
Yeah.
You're exactly right. Because I remember the people at CBS had paid not only for 80 to film it, which they did. They never showed it. And they paid in advance for 81. They didn't even bother to show the film it in 81.
That's true.
Right. And I read somewhere it was like $20,000, which that's a lot of money back in 1980, 1981, right? To not show the contest at all.
I did see the uncut version of the. I was in New York later that year, and I went to CBS, and the guy says, "If you'd like for me, the producer, if you'd like to see it, I'll show it to you." Wayne D'Amelio, myself. Chris Dickerson was there. He saw it. Mm-hmm. And then Wayne's wife at the time, we watched it. He says, "We could never show this on TV. It's so bad that the wrong guy won." He said, "We can't put that on TV. So we're done with it."
Yeah. That's amazing when it's a television producer who really doesn't know anything about bodybuilding. You know?
Exactly. Yeah. He didn't know anything about bodybuilding. He was just there to film the thing.
But he could say that,
you know, the wrong guy won.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, here we are, what? 40 years later, nobody cares, but people still talk about it.
Imagine that. The people still talk about it,
want to raise hell about it, wasn't even born in 1980.
Right. it's still always debated whenever it's ever brought up on Facebook.
It's funny.
People still debate it back and forth. I mean, you know, it's going to get like 50 responses. That's ridiculous. Oh, yeah.
Big time.
Hey Bill, when you were friends with Chris and you got a chance to know him, you go talking. Did he ever talk a lot about that 80 and 81 Olympia?
Yeah, he did. He said, well, you know, when he would do interviews or whatever, he always said, well, you know, really, I was thrilled because, you know, the year before, I think he was fourth in 89 at 79, and he said, now I'm bumped up to second, and second to Arnold Schwarzenegger is nothing to sneeze at. And after all, Arnold is Arnold. He's got that something about him.
Yeah.
Everyone not his best. And Chris was kind of philosophical about it. And I'll tell you how that kind of worked in his favor years later. Chris was hospitalized for one of his surgeries here in Fort Lauderdale in like the mid 2015 or 14. And none of the nurses knew who he was. I mean, Chris, you know, he doesn't quite look like he did in his competitive days, you know, glasses. And you really wouldn't know who he was if you weren't a bodybuilding fan. And he's in the hospital and he gets this get well card and a bouquet of roses from Arnold Schwarzenegger and Maria Shriver. And Chris said his stock just went right up at that hospital. All the nurses way to treat him because Arnold was really thankful that Chris never made a big stink about the 80 Olympia. Chris just kind of let it roll up. And Arnold always loved Chris that he didn't, because arguably he could have. And he didn't, you know. Yeah. But Chris was pretty philosophical about it. But the 81, he took really hard, and he was going to quit. And Winston Roberts talked to him, and of course, he went to his mentor Bill, and Bill told him, "Look, Chris, if you quit, they've won. Show them you're not going away." Mm-hmm. And he came back in 82, you know, and he really, really trained hard for that. But yeah, that 81 was just, and how coincidental. Arnold wins every year. The year Arnold retires, the next year his buddy Franco beats Frank's end by half a point, 76. Arnold comes back after 5 years, a shadow of himself, wins. Okay. Franco comes back 5 years later, not near as good as his prime, wins.
Shadow of himself.
Everybody's saying, come on.
Yeah.
You know, it was such a black eye for bodybuilding.
Yeah.
Yep. Got us off TV for good.
Yeah.
I want to say something, because I know Roy will remember this. At the pre-judging in the 1980 Mr. Olympia.
Yeah.
So you got a certain protocol rules to follow. Franco comes on stage. Okay. On stage. Now he's in the contest. He's on stage. And it was very, very intense. It was hot because of all the TV lights. And Franco is there fanning Arnold with a towel to keep him cool. And that's on stage, you know?
Yeah.
This is not a contest. It's like a circus here.
Right, so, right.
But I know Roy will remember that. I'm thinking, what the hell is going on here? And they let him get away with it.
Yep.
And they let him get away with the poses too, Boyer, right? Because he went in his side tricep pose. And, yeah. When I interviewed Frank Zane, he told me a story. I don't know if you guys remember. He said Dennis Stallard was the judging guy on stage.
He was.
And he threatened to have Arnold thrown out of the contest if he didn't hit the poses. And Frank said, by the time you guys got back to the night show, they found out that Dennis Stallard had been removed and sent back home.
Yeah, he never was in another show after that.
Wow.
He was a high official, but somehow or another they immediately eliminated that. That's true.
Yep.
Jeez. Wow.
That's true.
Yeah, Bill, Chris didn't really like Franco, right? I mean, they didn't really get along very well.
No, no. And that wasn't Chris's fault. I think to really tell it straight, I think Franco was uncomfortable with Chris and knew Chris was gay.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Franco had the problem with it. Chris didn't have the problem with Franco. Franco had the problem with Chris. And Chris just went his way, you know, and avoided him. I think Franco always thought he was superior to Chris.
Mm-hmm.
But in the universes, Chris always beat him.
He beat him in the
universe, Chris always beat Columbo.
Right.
But I think Franco had the problem with Chris. Chris didn't have the problem with Franco.
Okay.
But yeah, he didn't, you know, he didn't, they didn't socialize. They weren't friends.
Yeah. Yeah.
If you can tell anybody who Chris had a problem with, I'm willing to hear.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Chris was just a great ambassador for the sport. You know, I love reading on Facebook. I'll see something where some guy just chips in and says, you know, I was at an airport in 1978 and I saw Chris Dickerson. He was in a big hurry to catch a flight, but he stopped. He talked to me. He signed an autograph. And
yeah.
You know, that's the things you never forget.
Yeah. Yeah. He was also a fantastic poser, too, right? I mean, all the articles I've read, especially in those Grand Prix shows, Roy, in the 1980s, they always talked about his posing. They said, you know, Corny was the one who started it, and then Chris kind of took over from where Ed Corny left off with the posing.
And I think that was mainly because, but I don't know, he never told me that. He did tell me he did a little ballet, but I think that was because of his classical training.
Yeah.
He knew how to present a package.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it was just a way of him. I think it fit in with his physique, which was very symmetrical and very classical. And then he did that classical type of posing too, you know.
Yes, he wouldn't do anything that anybody else did because he didn't have the person's physique to do that. He was listen, man. I took the time, I rushed home, I dumped some clients to get here late, but I don't care. It's Chris Dickerson. And if I remember what I remember of him, I cannot find anything negative.
Yeah.
And it was a pleasure for me even to put in my two little cents. But I love hearing Boris' stories. I don't think there's another bodybuilder around with with Boris Cole's he's deep. This the thing that he can tell you. I think if he started writing the book, it'll be as thick as an encyclopedia. This guy, Boris Cole is.
Nobody's start got a doing memory
it,
like Boris.
Start doing it, man. Start doing it.
Well, Arthur Jones told me one time, if everybody just wrote an absolute truth about their life, they could write a bestseller. Nobody reads books anymore, you know.
Right.
I hate to cut this short, but I have a meeting I have to get to.
Okay.
Unfortunately, I got to sign off. John, thank you so much. Roy, it's wonderful having a chance to visit with you. Bill,
always, brother.
You guys have
same
a great
here, my brother.
All right. Thank you, Boyer. Thanks for joining us.
See you, Boyer.
Okay.
All right. I guess we'll just end this right here then, guys. Any last words about Chris, Bill?
Well, he just left a tremendous legacy. I think he was kind and professional to everybody that he encountered. He was really good to me. You know, he was my coach my last couple of contests, and he refused. I had to force him to take the money. He wouldn't accept any. And I had to force him. I said, Chris, I don't care if I give you a charity.
Yeah.
You know, I want to seal the deal this way, you know. But I mean, everybody he encountered, he was kind, and he had an understanding of the effect he had on people. Mm-hmm. You know, that it was. And I think he learned a lot of that from Bill Pearl.
Yeah.
He learned a lot from Bill. Bill was his mentor and father figure. And you know, Chris took everything Bill taught him and used it to his benefit.
Yeah.
Just mm-hmm. class all the way. Chris was understated. And like, and Roy, you're the same way. But Boyer, Bill, Chris Dickerson, they have a quiet dignity about themselves.
Mm-hmm.
They know who Chris. They are. They know what they've done. And yes. What's marvelous is when you go to talk to them about their accomplishments, they get a little uncomfortable and they want to change the subject.
Yeah.
You know, and it makes them all the more appealing.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Chris was that way. You know, he'd play it that well. I was very fortunate that year. I said, fortunate my ass, Chris, you beat everybody. You know? I wanted to ask Boyer a quick question, but he got away. You know, it must have been tough for Boyer in 1981. That was probably his greatest year.
I wanted to bring that up, too.
He stayed out of the Olympia. He stuck to his guns and did not do the Olympia, but it was probably his greatest competitive year.
Yeah, I wanted to mention that, too, because on my podcast, we were doing a 1981 in review. So I was going over all the contests, and I kind of forgot about those Grand Prix shows that were held after the Olympia that year, mm-hmm. I think in the fall. And I think a lot of them were overseas, right, Roy? Were you in some of those?
Yeah, I had quit in Essen.
Okay.
I did not want to Barcelona. That's when I threw my trunks and everything in the garbage and my oil and left.
but Boyer won a lot of those. I think he won every one of those shows, right, Bill?
Yeah, he won seven in 81. But also, if you look at the records, Roy, you and Chris and Boyer went back and forth for winning titles, and Albert was in there. Albert Beckles,
that year.
Like 1 and 2, and you'd win, and then the next show Boyer would win, and you were second, and then Albert was right in there. He'd win one, and Chris would take second to Albert, and you guys went interchangeable. You guys were so good.
In that span
of like 79 to 81, you guys were unbelievable.
Yeah,
81.
All of you, the level of competition and the level of development was fabulous. You guys were unbelievable.
Yeah. And they had so many of those Grand Prix shows too, you know.
Oh, yeah.
They had a bunch of the spring.
They were fun, man. They were fun.
Yeah. Yeah.
I remember Boyer looking amazing. I didn't even bother when he got off stage. They took my check and left. Because this guy was New Jersey.
Yeah.
I've never seen him look that good before nor since.
Hmm.
Which show was that, Roy? Which show?
It was a Grand Prix. It was a Grand Prix. Yeah. And that was my opinion. And Albert wanted to fight. I said, no, forget it, man. He's got it. He doesn't know what the hell he did.
Yeah.
But Boy has got it today. He's got it. He's on.
Yeah. Yeah. When I look back at your careers, Roy, I mean, it's just amazing how many years it spans, you know, from the 60s, the 70s, all the way into the 80s. I mean, I don't think we'll see that anymore today in modern bodybuilding, but when you guys were champions from amateurs to pros, and you had such a long history together. That's why I wanted to get everybody together today to talk about Chris, because I know you had so many, it was decades of competing, really, you know?
Yeah, but there was a different time. You say modern bodybuilders, with all due respect, John, I really cannot refer to the bodybuilders today as bodybuilders, because
mm-hmm.
I like bodybuilders that represent something. And at a time, bodybuilders, even today, bodybuilders still live very long years.
Yeah.
The young bodybuilders, unfortunately, not. So I really don't refer to the younger guys as bodybuilders. They're great chemists. Mm-hmm. They're great engineers of using certain. I don't know. I don't refer to bodybuilding anymore. I don't watch anymore. I'm sorry, but
well, that's what I'm saying. I mean, back then it was like you guys were around for so long. You were in so many shows and different organizations and the professionals.
We are bodybuilders.
Yeah.
We are bodybuilders.
We're
bodybuilders, John.
It's a long career, you know.
Yeah. That's what bodybuilding is. Bodybuilding.
Yeah.
Well, I think Roy too, what I admired about you guys so much when I was coming up in the late 60s is it wasn't in vogue back then. It wasn't really popular.
Right.
But you guys, you know, I knew who Mr. Universe was, and that's what you guys did it with a passion. There was no money. The passion was there, and there's no passion today.
Mm-hmm.
You guys did it for passion. It didn't matter that it was the most popular sport. It wasn't. It was a subculture back then.
It was,
A few of us had admired you guys and looked up and wanted to be like you guys and would get the magazines. Again, before you came on, I was discussing with John and Boyer that you guys were images in the magazines. We never heard your voices. I had pictures of you in 1970 with my buddy. We trained together. I never heard your voice. I never saw you move. I never saw you move. We were just waiting for the next issue to come out to see what you guys were doing next.
Yeah, this was seminars. This is why seminars were so popular. Yeah, I spend a lot of time on the road doing seminar here, guest appearance there.
Guest closings are super popular too.
Yeah.
You never got to see them. You know, you never saw them except for the magazines.
And that's how we wanted to meet you guys. We were so thrilled if you ever came because you weren't accessible. I never dreamed of meeting Roy Callender. Are you kidding me? You're like Bob Hope. You know, you never meet Bob Hope.
Right.
You know, Roy Callender, he's in the magazines. I'll never meet him.
Yeah. That's how it was. Yeah. Now we don't have magazines anymore. We communicate directly. Look at this. Yeah.
That's how I felt about Boyer and Chris, you know, and to be friends with them now and know them. It's just surreal for me. And John, I'm sure, feels the same way. We were huge fans of you guys. And to see that you're accessible and you're friendly, and that's what was so great about Chris. He's very classy, but he's very disarming. He's very cool. He's comfortable. There's no air about him when you meet him.
I was trying to find words, but I everybody said everything, man. If someone is a son of a bitch, I can't say... I wouldn't say a word. Vince Amon was as nice and accommodating and gentle and humble as Chris Dickerson.
Yeah.
And I gave up clients to come and sit down and talk to you about him. Mm-hmm. I'm paying respects to him by so doing. That is all.
Yeah.
It means something to me. I don't know about all the other bodybuilders, but Chris, special guy.
Yeah.
I mean, he rest in peace, man. He's pretty cool.
Yeah. He was a great guy. And I brought him out. I don't know if you remember, Bill, I brought him out to one of my contests to have him sing the national anthem back in 2015.
Yes. Sure.
And the people that were there, you know, like I remember my MC and stuff, he was speechless, just to meet Chris Dickerson, because he was aware of the history of the sport. And, you know, and you're right. Mm-hmm. That's how Chris handled it so well. You know, he just was very, very great with everybody he met, you know.
Yep.
Yeah.
Thank you, John. I think we did him an honor. I think he'd be proud of what we did.
Yeah. Yeah. I thought it was important to mention him and, to do a little show about him, because Chris was a great champion, a legend in the sport for sure.
And human being.
For the last decades.
Above all, human being.
Yes.
Thank you for doing this, John. I really appreciate you doing this.
Absolutely, Bill. Thanks for coming on the show and sharing your memories with Chris, with us. And Roy, also thank you for changing your schedule and coming out here to talk to us.
Chris, pleasure.
Yeah. All right, guys. Okay, well, thank you for joining me on the podcast. I hope to have you guys on again soon, and hope you have a great day.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, John.
Okay.
Great to see you, Roy.
Oh, same here, my brother. Thank you.
All right, Roy. Take care.
Bye.
All right. Thanks for listening to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. I really want to thank Boyer Co. and Roy Callender and Bill Nealon all for joining me. Roy said that he canceled some clients just so he could get home on time and join us for that phone call. So I really appreciate those guys joining us. And it's always great to talk to Boyer Co. as well as Bill Nealon also. So that was a great tribute. I hope we did justice to Chris Dickerson. I didn't want to let a podcast go by without talking about Chris, because he was such a big influence in bodybuilding and he had such an amazing career. And although he lived to 82, we hated to see him go. And it was great to talk about him, at least for an hour, to give him a little tribute. All right. So before I let you guys go, I'm going to read this article. It's called Elegance is the Game, Dickerson's the Name. Hopefully I can read this with my condition. It's written by Bill Reynolds and Armand Tanney and comes from the January 1980 issue of Muscle and Fitness magazine. So this must have been right after Chris won the Canada Cup, which was held a couple of weeks after the Mr. Olympia in 1979. It says, in 1964, Chris Dickerson entered his first bodybuilding contest, Mr. Long Beach, and he placed third. I was delighted, he says. To this day, I love that trophy more than any other I've won. After that, he moved east from California and he won 11 titles in 12 months. Mr. New York, Mr. Gotham, Mr. New York State, Mr. Eastern America, etc. He then invaded the national scene with his junior Mr. USA victory. He returned to California in 1967, and with the guidance of Bill Pearl, he won Mr. California, topping some of that era's best amateurs, Chuck Colras, John Balick, and Don Peters. In 1968, he hit the big time by taking the Mr. USA title, beating Boyer Co. In 1969, he placed second in the Mr. America, only one quarter of a point separating from the winner, Coe. The following year, he won Mr. America. After that, he won his height class at the NABBA Mr. Universe, beating Franco Colombo. In 1973, he won the amateur Mr. Universe, and in 1974, the professional Mr. Universe. Then he tore a pec deltoid while bench pressing. For several years after that, it was impossible for him to train properly, and for all intents and purposes, he disappeared from the international scene. Last February, he received a letter from Warren Langman inviting him to compete in the Diamond Cup in Vancouver. People were asking me, Chris, why don't you compete these days? He says, it's nice to be asked, you know, even though you're out of shape. Langman thought enough of me to ask, though he knew I was out of shape. Ironically, the contest fell on my 40th birthday. I thought, wouldn't that be nice to stand up on that stage that day in top condition? So I started training. How things change. Chris Dickerson, people now say in disbelief, he almost beat Roy Callender. Yep, on that day, on his 40th birthday, Dickerson scared the bejesus out of Callender, coming in a close second after a neck-and-neck race right down to the last flex. Okay, I correct myself. I thought Chris won that show, but he actually got second. Callender won the $25,000 diamond first prize, but the $5,000 Chris took home for finishing second wasn't exactly chicken feed either. Okay, so this was August 25th that the Canada Cup took place, and then Chris did the Olympia after that. And then there was another contest in Canada where Chris won. So sorry, I forgot for that, guys. I made a mistake on that. In the following exclusive interview with Muscle Builder, the resurgent Mr. Dickerson, who now divides his time between New York and Los Angeles, talks about bodybuilding, art, music, the dynamics of growing old with the sport. Let's start with your opera activities, Chris. It's known that you have taken a lot of voice lessons. I left Los Angeles after winning the NABBA Professional Universe in London in 1974. I thought, now I'll put bodybuilding behind me and just train for my well-being. Opera was my second love, so I thought I'd put all my attention on that, thinking I could have a career in opera, eventually singing on the Metropolitan Opera stage. I always think big in everything I do. When I first saw a picture of a bodybuilder, I couldn't just look at it and admire it. I knew I had to do it. I felt the same when I listened to the singing of Franco Corelli. That set an example for me to follow, just like Bill Pearl and others set an example for me in bodybuilding. What was the genesis of these opera efforts? You must have felt that you had some talent along those lines. Had you taken lessons before? Yes, I had, in a funny way. I was taking voice lessons when my voice teacher suggested I take up weight training. That would help build my lungs. It was then that I discovered Bill Pearl's gym. Mario Lanza also used to train with weights. Does opera singing take that much force? Yes, it does. Singing opera is a real workout. Great singers doing big roles lose 10 to 15 pounds of performance. They are wringing wet. It's an athletic feat. I've had a few opera teachers both in LA and New York. I love it. It's given me a new dimension. I've studied acting, ballet, and fencing as well. It all comes together in my bodybuilding, which I think is an art too. It epitomizes perfection in my mind. A friend and I were watching a physique exhibition on television, and he said, "It's interesting, Chris, that bodybuilding is either the most fantastic thing or the most ludicrous thing to watch." I think he's right. We are walking a thin line between being arty and being ridiculous. If it's done badly, nothing looks worse. How is it that you've come up with such a supremely aesthetic physique as opposed to many others in the game? Well, I was blessed with the right ingredients. We all have flaws, of course. I was fortunate to have a good metabolism and body structure. My biceps is my one weak area, but it's getting better. Much of it is mental. The main thing is I always did bodybuilding as a science. I never fooled around with weights in someone's garage or basement on a Saturday afternoon. I didn't know anybody who trained with weights. I think my bodybuilding began with Bill Pearl watching me. I had a training card with everything written out on it. Bill has personally instructed something like 75,000 people in his gyms over the years. Right. And for me, it was striving for perfection, never just fooling around. I weighed 145 pounds at 5'6" when I started. I had natural calves. They run in my family. I'm one of triplets, and we all had big calves. My calves made me stick out. They were kind of a gimmick. If you have something like that in bodybuilding, fine, use it. I think I've won contests on the sheer impact of my calves. I do emphasize them in my posing, but not overly so. When I do a back double bicep shot, I let my calf development show. My calves are there, and I want people to see them, but not at the expense of the rest of me. I'm still striving to get a better body overall. Do you follow Pearl's philosophy of having a balanced physique with no body part emphasized over another? When you look at a man like Bill Pearl, he doesn't look that awesome because he is so perfectly proportioned. The same with Lou Ferrigno. You have to be close to him to see how huge he is because he's so proportioned. When you're big without being proportioned, you're sort of awesome in a funny way. It's not the ideal. Only when everything is together do you get the necessary continuity. You mentioned earlier that you once saw a picture that inspired you to become a bodybuilder. Do you recall who that person was and the circumstances? Yes, it was a bodybuilder named Leroy Saba. It was a side chest shot on the cover of Iron Man magazine. I could tell he was short. It was about 1961. I could identify with him because of his height. Now that I've won the titles I have, I'm more confident, and I don't see myself as a short man. But they didn't have height classes at the time, just the overall winner. There's an old saying that a good tall man will always beat a good short man. Do you agree or disagree? I agree. A short man has to be better built and in better condition than a tall man. Second, is it easier for a short man to build a quality physique in less time than a tall man? I agree there too. Everything shows quicker. A taller man has to fill out more. However, once he has done it, he can overshadow a short man. Also, I think people like to see a tall man. I can't imagine Lou Ferrigno being the Hulk if he wasn't tall. How would you evaluate your condition at the Diamond Cup contest this year compared with the rest of your career? I would say it's about the best I've ever been. It was a tremendous satisfaction. Now I want to carry it to the ninth degree, barring injury. Now I'd like to become the first AAU Mr. America to win the Olympia title. I'm making better gains than ever before. I'm amazed. My metabolism is fast, my muscle texture is excellent, and my skin tone perfect. Are there any concessions you have to have that you've had to make as to age, such as better and longer warm-ups, more vitamins, and so on? No, I think the age is an advantage. Physiologically, I don't notice any deficit. Mentally, I've been able to cut incidentals out of my life, and I'm better able to zero in on my training. There might be an element of desperation considering the time left, but only a little bit. I've done just about everything else that I wanted to do in bodybuilding. I've had the high life, and I've traveled. Why do you think you're making better gains now than when you were, say, 25? Well, I was a late starter. I started at 23, so I was merely getting underway at 25. In that sense, I guess you could say my body's still young. What sort of knowledge do you think you have now about life and training that you didn't have then? Well, I know better now how the mind and the enthusiasm control of the body. Bodybuilding is a physical sport, yet it is so mental. It's fundamental. I walk into the gym now and I know exactly what I want to do. I zero in and cut through my training like a knife. I find I can talk to people and be friendly without it detracting from my workout. I always take time to answer questions between sets. In fact, I'm refreshed when I go back to the sets. I'll permit 60 seconds to go by and I'm back on the job. I know where I want to be. Do you have to psych yourself up with mental exercises like Frank Zane does to improve his abilities in the sport? What excites you the most about training? No, my training feeds on itself. One set influences the next one. And progress always excites me, looking in the mirror and seeing it happen. I am making better progress now than I did during my first year of training. Also, I'm making this comeback and people are talking about it, which is so satisfying. My showing in Vancouver excites me. Only one point behind the great Roy Callender. I've been out of competitive bodybuilding for 3.5 years. Now my training has become a total commitment. If it wasn't for bodybuilding, what other field do you think you'd be working in to achieve recognition? I probably would be in law. My parents were both lawyers. As for the ego thing, I'm better about that now than I used to be. I can wear a t-shirt and not feel self-conscious. Years ago, I could never do that. I find it easier living in California with its attitudes. I've never walked down a street in a t-shirt to see people go ape. Never. Does your interest in other art forms inspire you in your bodybuilding efforts? Does watching Baryshnikov in a ballet performance spur your own efforts? I go to the museum to see the sculpture. I watch ballet. I think it's fantastic. I love football. Having studied ballet myself, I know that when your feet are planted firmly on the floor and you know where they are, then you can do anything with your upper body. In posing, just as in ballet, you need balance. When you pose to music, you should not let the music take you. I practice my posing without music. Too many bodybuilders use strong music like Beethoven or Wagner, and they're led by the music. In Vancouver, I posed to The Impossible Dream. It suited the moment, and it suited what I was striving for. Many think bodybuilding is the most demanding sport of all. What's your opinion? I think it is. We are grinders. We are the hardest working people in the world. We get little in return. That's not entirely true because no one can take our physiques away from us. But from a practical standpoint, we get less than anyone. Our work never ends. We have other outside concerns like diet and recuperation. It's a 24-hour job. A lot of people say you can't hold down a regular job and still be a bodybuilding champion. I don't agree. I think the busier you are, the more successful you become at anything you do. You use your time better. People who hang around gyms are never the champions. The champion works within a preset time schedule. I've gotten tremendous workouts in 50 minutes. How often do you train? Normally 6 days a week, and right now for the Olympia, 7. I do roughly 18 to 26 sets per body part, working each body part twice a week with medium to heavy weights, 30 to 60 seconds rest between sets. If I go to failure on sets, only some of the time, if you do that every set, you tear down. I have to talk to my biceps because they need the most encouragement. Would you type yourself a hard gainer? I'm an easy gainer. I'm a very talented bodybuilder. I love singing, but my voice is not as talented vocal instrument. When I open my mouth to sing, beautiful sounds just don't come out. I keep working at it, but it's just not natural to me. I'm a natural, organic bodybuilder, and I feel a moral obligation to keep it up. It's a God-given gift, and I don't want to waste it. Who's been your greatest influence in bodybuilding? Imitation is the greatest form of flattery. I still subconsciously imitate Bill Pearl. I think Bill has influenced me in different ways on many levels. Brother, confidant, father figure. I was a faithful student. Bill's love of the sport is transmitted to those who are in contact with him. What's your opinion of steroids? The prevailing attitude seems to stir the argument, good or bad. Do you or don't you? I think steroids have their place in bodybuilding if used sensibly. It's a bit like abortion. You can't sweep it under the rug. Don't go to Tijuana and risk infection. Have it done here. Legalize it. So legalize steroids. Let's set a standard. Discuss it openly. Come to some sort of agreement when and when not to take it. It's boring to hear people say they don't take it. You know they do. All right. So that was a very good interview with Chris Dickerson. And interesting, he talked about using weight training to build up his lungs for opera, because Bill mentioned that in the interview we just did. So that was interesting. And it was also interesting that he was beat by Roy Callender by 1 point. And we had Roy on the show today. So that was great. All right, folks, I am going to rest up and try to get better. And hopefully we will have Jerry Branham on next week to continue our discussion of the end of the year review. And we are now up to 1991. We're going to go 30 years back. We've already done 1971, 1981. So we're going to go back 1991 and talk about the Mr. Olympia that year, where Lee Haney won his last Mr. Olympia, beating out Dorian Yates. We'll also talk about the Night of the Champions that Dorian won. We'll talk about the Arnold Classic that Sean Ray won. And we'll also talk about the NPC Nationals that Kevin Livroni won. So we got a lot to talk about next week with Jerry Branham. I hope you guys can make it, and take care of yourselves out there. And we'll talk to you guys next week. Take care.